Hi there, this is Lon Solomon, and I'd like to welcome you to our program today. You know, it's a tremendous honor that God has given us to be on stations all around the nation, bringing the truth of God's Word as it is, uncompromising and straightforward. And I'm so glad you've tuned in to listen and be part of that. Thanks again for your support and your generosity that keeps us on the radio. And now, let's get to the Word of God.
Well, we're going to have some fun together this morning for the next few minutes. You know, if you're Jewish, you can only grow up to be one of three things, and I'm Jewish. Those are a doctor, a lawyer, or failure. And a preacher definitely falls in category number three, if you understand what I'm saying. Now, how did a nice Jewish boy like me end up doing what I do for a living? That's what I want to tell you all about today. And I hope that as we talk about this, that maybe some little piece of my life will connect with some piece of your life, and that God will use what we're going to talk about today to really make a difference in your life. I was born and raised in Portsmouth, Virginia. Both my parents were Jewish. We were conservative Jews. You know, there are three major branches of Judaism: Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. We were conservative Jews. My mom lit Sabbath candles every Sabbath. We would go to synagogue on Sundays. I would go to Sunday school at the synagogue. My father would usually go to the men's breakfast and men's fellowship that they had every Sunday at the synagogue. I went to Hebrew school twice a week when I was in elementary school and junior high school. 2 days a week after school, we would all go to the synagogue and go to Hebrew school. And I was bar mitzvahed at age 13, the way every good Jewish boy ought to be. But you know, in terms of the real presence of God in our home, it really wasn't there. We didn't own a Bible. I'd never read a Bible. We didn't sit down and pray before meals. We never prayed at all in my home. We were run-of-the-mill, standard Jewish people who went through the things that you're supposed to go through as Jewish people. We went to high holiday services. We went to Yom Kippur. We had a Passover Seder at our home. But really, the presence of God Himself was just simply not a reality in our life. I can remember as a little boy praying a few times. I can remember laying in bed as a little boy, trying to talk to God. I can even remember a few prayers that I believe is, as a young child, God answered for me. And I kind of grew up believing that God probably existed. I mean, I had a sense that God was out there somewhere, but I didn't know Him. I didn't know anything about Him. I had no connection with Him at all. And this is how I grew up. Well, when I was 13, I was bar mitzvahed. And then immediately after that, I would help reading the Torah in the synagogue. Sometimes I would go over for daily services, which happened, and I would read the Torah a little bit, because I was pretty good at that. But when I got to high school, my whole relationship with the synagogue began to change. I got interested in other things, girls and partying and drinking, and let's face it, guys, the synagogue just didn't hold much of a candle compared to that stuff, you know. And so I began to trail off in terms of going to synagogue. And the real coup de grace came when I was about 16, maybe just approaching 17. I was involved in the acting group at high school, in the thespian troupe. And so I was sitting and talking one day with a girl that was also in the play. She began asking me about my personal relationship with God. Well, I'd never even heard of a personal relationship with God. Never really talked or thought much about heaven or hell, because you just don't talk about that in the synagogue. And she kind of shook me up a little bit. So the very next time I was at the synagogue, I asked the rabbi if I could talk to him, and I asked him a question. I said, "Rabbi, I need to know, do Jews go to heaven or hell?" He said, "Here's what I need to tell you." He said, "All Jewish people go to heaven." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, hell," he said, "is a Gentile problem." I said, "That's wonderful, but just so I can defend myself, explain to me why this is so I can tell this girl." He said, "Well, we are all Abraham's descendants, and as Abraham's descendants, we have a kind of a different arrangement with God than the rest of the world does." And I said, "You mean to tell me that I could do all kinds of stuff, you know, and I could lie and I could be nasty and I'm still going to heaven because I'm Abraham's descendant? And he said, yeah, and actually, you know, there is a passage that I ran into many years later while I was doing graduate work at Johns Hopkins University from the Mishnah, from the Jewish rabbinic writings, that actually says that very same thing. It's in the Tractate Sanhedrin, and it says that very thing, that except for a couple of real bums, every Jewish person's going to heaven. So I was like, wow, this is fabulous. And I thought to myself, you mean even if I never come to synagogue again, I'm still going to heaven? And the answer is yes. And so that was pretty much the end of my relationship with synagogue. Anyway, I went off to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill as an 18-year-old young man, confident that I was going to heaven because I was Jewish. And that was pretty much the end of the story. But I went off to the University of North Carolina excited about being out from under my parents' roof. And excited now about being able to do everything I'd always fantasized about doing. But, you know, when you're living at home, you can't pull it off, you know. So I joined a social fraternity when I got to Chapel Hill. And if you saw the movie Animal House, my fraternity made Animal House look like, you know, a Christian day school. I mean, you just cannot imagine what went on. And I began getting deeply involved in drinking and partying and women and gambling. We'd start playing cards around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd play all night long, wake up and, you know, eat some lunch, and about 3, 4 o'clock, start again. And this was life in the fraternity house. You say, well, what about classes? All you had to do was take enough classes to stay out of the Vietnam War in those days, and everything was fine, and get a 2.0, and everything was copacetic. Well, I did a couple of years of that, but by the beginning of my junior year, all of that was starting to get old. And after a while, it's like getting drunk one more time, having one more woman. It's just not all that exciting anymore. So by the time I was beginning my junior year and all that started getting stale, I had begun, you know, to think a little more seriously about the issues of life. You know, where was I going? What am I doing here? And you know, those questions were beginning to plague me, and I didn't have any answers for them. And so I ended up that summer up in the Borscht Belt, up in the Catskills Mountains. A couple friends of mine and I, we had hitchhiked up there, and we were looking for a job. And we finally found a job working in one of the restaurants and serving people. And we made a lot of money that summer. But this was the summer of 1969. And although when I went up there, I'd never heard the word Woodstock and had no idea what the word Woodstock represented, the Woodstock Music Festival was happening not too very far from where we were working. And some friends of mine that I made up there who were from New York said, hey, we need to go to Woodstock. And I'm like, that's cool. What is it? And they explained to me it's this big music festival. And I was like, that's wonderful. So we all bought tickets. I may be one of the very few people in the world who actually bought a ticket to Woodstock. They did sell them, honestly. I wish I had kept it. I mean, it would be worth a lot today. I didn't. But I went to Woodstock, spent the entire weekend there, and as a part of this whole New York experience, began to get very deeply involved in drugs. I had dabbled with drugs in Chapel Hill before I had gone up to New York, but when I got up to New York, was the first time I ever dropped LSD. I had some friends who said, you know, if you're looking for answers to questions about the universe, you need to take this stuff. This stuff will help put you in touch with real expanded consciousness. And I was like, that sounds cool. Let's do it. And so the first time I ever took LSD was up in New York that summer. And as I began taking LSD, I came back to Chapel Hill to start the next year of school, convinced that I had gotten into the pathway to expand my mind. And I came back as a very strong advocate of drugs. As a matter of fact, about 50 or 60% of the people in my fraternity who have ended up using drugs, I was the one who initially talked them into it, initially encouraged them to do it, and the one who initially provided the drugs for them to get involved. And we began doing drugs all the time. I mean, we would smoke dope many times a day. I grew hair out to my shoulders, a big old afro. See, my hair doesn't grow down, it grows out. And I wore bell bottoms, a tank top, motorcycle boots, and love beads, and really looked the part. And so a normal day in Chapel Hill would start off with 6 or 8 joints, and as the day went on, we would smoke them. That was a normal day in Chapel Hill. We dropped LSD 3, 4, 5 times a week. You say, well, Lon, if you're taking LSD 3, 4, 5 times a week and smoking dope every day, how in the world did you ever maintain any presence in class? The answer is we didn't. As a matter of fact, I brought a copy of my yearbook, 1969-1970, because there's a picture right in the front, a full-page picture of me and several fraternity brothers sitting up in a tree smoking dope. But that was life in Chapel Hill. And I'm not telling you this because I'm proud of those days and proud of my lifestyle. I'm telling you this because I want you to get a sense of who I was at age 21 when Jesus Christ reached down and grabbed a hold of my life. I was living a lifestyle that was about as separated from Jesus Christ and Christianity as you could possibly imagine. I may be the only person in the history of the University of North Carolina to have flunked honors chemistry. I got into honors chemistry because my chemistry grades the first 2 years weren't too bad, but then I never went to class, never showed up except for the first day. At the end of the semester, the guy gave me an F. I thought, how dare he give me an F? So I went to see him, and I pleaded for a D. And he said, are you kidding? You were never here. And he flunked me. I had to stay and go to summer school because I flunked honors chemistry. All you do is show up, and you get an A. I got an F. I also became well known in the city of Chapel Hill as a dope pusher. We would get dope from New York City. We would travel up there, buy large shipments of dope, bring it back to Chapel Hill, cut it, and sell it. We had a friend who went to Amsterdam several times a year and would bring hash back sewn into the inside lining of his overcoat. And he generally had no problem whatsoever getting huge amounts of dope in from Europe. Then we would sell it, and we would go. I would put myself through my last 2 years of school selling dope. That's how I made my money. I wouldn't want to go out and get a regular job. You can make a lot more money, and it was a whole lot easier work just selling dope to people, and that's what we did. You say, well, how in the world did you stay out of the grasp of the law? I mean, how is it that you didn't get, you know, yourself arrested? Well, the truth is, I almost did. In the spring of 1971, just before I became a Christian, a matter of a couple of weeks before I made a decision for Christ, there was a knock one morning at the door at the house where I was staying, and it was the police. And there was a guy sleeping out in the living room, and the police said, we have a warrant, this is a totally true story, for the arrest of Lon Solomon on dope charges. Is he here? Well, I was there. I was back in my bedroom. And my friend at the front door had enough presence of mind to say, could I please see the search warrant? They had a search warrant for the house. And the search warrant had the wrong address. It had the address of the house next door on it. And he picked this up, and he said, you can't come in here. This search warrant is not for this house. It's the house next door. You got the wrong address on here. And they actually went next door. The people living next door were friends of ours, fraternity brothers of ours. We had sold them the dope that was in their house. They found the dope, went to class, arrested my fraternity brother right out of his class, put handcuffs on him, and took him to jail. He got arrested, but it wasn't him they were looking for. It was me. So that's how close it was. We were well known. I mean, the police knew who we were. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. All the time I was doing dope like this, I want to tell you, I actually thought that I was making spiritual progress. And I actually thought that spiritually I was moving towards a place where I was going to get all these answers to the universe that I cared about. And again, I'm telling you all that because I want you to understand where I was in 1970 when Jesus Christ began to make an impact on my life. Now, the real turning point in my life, as I look back, came in the very early spring of 1971. I was sitting on a wall in downtown Chapel Hill. There's a little wall right there, if you've ever been there, right on the edge of campus. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. My friend and I, a good fraternity brother that I did a lot of dope with, he and I were sitting there, tripped out on LSD. And we were talking, and I said to him as part of this conversation, I said, you know, David, something really bothering me. I said, you know, here we are, we're doing all these drugs, and we're the flower people, you know, we're the love children. But instead of getting better, instead of getting more loving and more caring, I feel like I'm getting worse. And he turned to me and he said, and I don't know that, you know, he wasn't a Christian, and I don't know he had any sense of the impact he was about to make on my life. But he turned to me and he said, Lon, he said, maybe you're not getting worse. He said, maybe you're just getting more honest about what you've really been all the time. I was like, whoa, dude, that's heavy, man. And to him it was a passing comment. To me it was like a sledgehammer had hit my life. Because, you know, I had grown up believing my own PR. I had grown up believing I was a good person, a nice person, a kind person, a giving person, an unselfish person, and a person that was going to heaven. That's what my rabbi told me. And all of a sudden, I was faced with the fact that maybe I wasn't all of that. All of a sudden, I was confronted with the fact that maybe the truth is that that was all a bunch of PR that I had blown out, and that the real me was a very different person. And the more I thought about what he said to me, the more I began to realize that he was right. And as I began coming to grips with this, really taking a hard, honest look at myself, I want to tell you what I saw I didn't like. And all of a sudden, my perspective on myself totally began to change. Suddenly, I began to see myself as a person in need. Not a person that was fine and doing all right, but a person in deep and desperate need. Suddenly, I began to see myself as being selfish and self-centered and self-ingratiating, a person who was immoral, a person who was unethical, a person who was profane. And I had to finally admit to myself, you know, Lon, to see yourself any other way, you are kidding yourself, friend. You are deceiving yourself, and it's a big game. You are not the person you always projected that you were. This is what you really were, and it was not a pretty picture. Well, I began to realize as a result of this that I needed help. I needed some change. I needed someone or something that could change me from the inside out. That was a major turning point in my life, because up to that point, I didn't really feel I needed any outside help. But now I did, and it began to grip me. Drugs began to become passé at that point in my life, because I realized I'd been doing them for years now. I realized they could not change me from the inside out, and I decided I needed religion. I needed God in some form or another. So the first form I got into was Eastern religions. I went down and bought all these books on Eastern religions. Taoism, I read a lot of that. Confucianism, read a lot of that. Got a lot of books on Zen Buddhism by Alan Watts and other writers, and read a lot of those books. And you know what was interesting about these Eastern religions? They sounded wonderful on paper, but I just couldn't make them work in real life. I mean, I would go out and read Zen Buddhism for the first 3 hours of the morning sitting in the woods with my legs crossed, you know, under a tree. And then I would get up and say to my friend, hey, what's for lunch? And blow my whole Zen for the day. And I couldn't make this work. I really tried. I mean, I wanted to cut my hair in a ponytail and go dance around on the street with the Hare Krishnas and do all this stuff. Except I hated their food. Have you ever eaten that food? It's awful. So I gave up on being a Hare Krishna because of that. But I was trying to make the rest of this work, and I couldn't. So I decided, all right, I'm not going to be an Eastern religion person. And I decided maybe what I need to do is I need to go back to Judaism. And maybe I can find in Orthodox Judaism the answers that I need for life. So there was a campus rabbi, and I went to visit the campus rabbi. I walked into his office with my hair and my bell bottoms and everything, and I plopped down in his chair, and I said to him, Rabbi, yeah? I said, I think God wants me to be a rabbi. And he looked at me and he said, no, I don't think so. I said, but Rabbi, listen, I have some deep-seated needs in my life. I've got some questions I really need answers for. And I began sharing with him about the hunger of my heart, sharing with him about the needs that I had. I don't even think he had a clue what I was talking about. He gave me a couple of books to read. I didn't want books. I wanted somebody to come up and sit down next to me and look me in the eyes and say, I know the answers to the questions you're asking. I know how you can get changed on the inside and not be the ugly person that you've realized you are. And I can help you. I don't think he even had a clue how to do that. And I walked out of his office and said, nothing there for me. Now that was pretty depressing, because Judaism, going back to Judaism, had kind of always been my one ace in the hole. You know, I figure if everything else fails, I'll go back to Judaism. Now I've gone back, and I still have no answers as to how to change myself. And remember, guys, the issue for me at this point was not so much that I was concerned about going to hell. I still believe what the rabbi told me at that point, that I was going to heaven. That wasn't my issue. My issue was I couldn't find the resources I needed to live life. I couldn't find the answers I needed to make life make sense and make me into the kind of person I was proud to be. I couldn't find that. Those were my issues. Well, I would sit and talk to my fraternity brothers about these things. They thought I completely lost my mind. We would sit around and smoke dope, and then I would say to them, you know, guys, why are we here? And what's our purpose in life? And they would all go to me, oh, man, you know, you are bumming us out, man. You know, what is wrong with you, man? Why have you got to ask questions like this? Why don't you just graduate from college and get a job and get married and have kids and raise them up and be a grandfather and die like normal people? Why have you got to have answers to all these stupid questions? My friends began to think I'd flipped out. Began to wonder whether I'd lost my mind. And you know what? I began to wonder. I mean, you read about all these guys who go trip out on LSD and they never come back. And I thought, well, maybe I'm on one of these trips and I never came back. So I'm like, well, maybe I've never come back and I'm just don't know. Maybe I'm really in some psychiatric hospital and I'm going under shock therapy and I'm thinking I'm an orange and hiding under the bed or something, you know? Reality was really messed up for me in those days. I mean, that's where I really was. And I was so confused I didn't even know where reality was anymore. And I began to plan suicide. I said, no, this is stupid. It's absolutely stupid for me to grow up and live that kind of life and go through all the heartache and the pain of living life if I don't even know what I'm doing here and I don't even know what my purpose in life is and I hate the person I am on the inside. This is stupid. Why don't I just go ahead and take my life? And I was really planning on it. But I procrastinated so many things that I was going to. I just hadn't gotten around to it. But I had every intent. I had every intent of doing this. And in the spring of 1971, all of that changed. One spring day in Chapel Hill, I was walking on the streets of Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill is only about two blocks. And I was walking down Chapel Hill, this nice warm spring day, very crowded day, with my dog. I had a German Shepherd, about an 80-pound German Shepherd named Noah. I don't know why I named him Noah, but I'd had him since he was a pup. And he got into a fight, a little dog fight, right in front of the weirdest man in the universe. Let me tell you about the weirdest man in the universe. The weirdest man in the universe was a man named Bob Eckhart. Bob Eckhart was a man in his 40s at the time who worked in Durham, about 8 miles away from Chapel Hill. But he would come to Chapel Hill every Saturday with his Econoline van. He had scripture verses written all over the side of his Econoline van. He had two big megaphone speakers mounted on the roof of his van, connected up to a record player where he would play scratchy old 78 hymns and blast them down the street out of these two megaphones. He would stand out on the street corner of Chapel Hill handing out pamphlets about Jesus Christ, and he would do that along with his wife all day every Saturday. Now, he was not well received. People spit on him, people threw the tracts back at him, people cursed him out. But week after week after week that spring, I saw him down there. I avoided him. I didn't want to get near the man. This is like out of a circus or something. But anyway, that day my dog got into a fight right in front of where he was standing. And I pulled my dog apart from the dog that he was mangling at the time. And this other guy helped, Bob Eckhart helped me a little bit. And so here I am now, eyeball to eyeball with the weirdest man in the world. What do you say to the weirdest man in the world? I mean, I didn't want to say something wrong. So I looked at him and I said, hi. And he went, hello. Well, now what do you say? So I said, gotta go. And he said, okay, see ya. And I went, okay. And off I went. The whole encounter could not have lasted 30 seconds. But I have to tell you, in those 30 seconds of being eyeball to eyeball about 2 feet away from this man and looking in his eyes, I walked away and something inside of me said to me, Lon, this guy has what you're looking for. You say, how do you know that? Friends, I can't tell you how I knew it. I don't have any empirical evidence. I can't put it in a test tube what I was feeling. But I'm telling you, I walked away and something inside of me said, Lon, this guy's got what you're looking for. The peace, the contentment, the wholeness, the healthiness that you're looking for, he's got it. Man, that plagued me. I mean, that plagued me. But it also gave me some hope, because I have to tell you, folks, I had begun to wonder if anybody in the whole world had what I was looking for. I'd never met anybody who had answers to the questions that I was asking. My fraternity's brothers didn't. My drug buddies didn't. I didn't know anybody who had answers. I'd begun to think there are no answers to these questions. And suddenly, I met a man who gave me some hope. Maybe there really were some answers to these things.
You've been listening to So What with Dr. Lon Solomon. So What is an outreach of Lon Solomon Ministries. To To listen to today's message or for more information, visit our website, LonSolomonMinistries.org. Thank you for your support. If you would like to contact us, please visit our website or call us at 866-788-7770. We hope you will join us next time when Lon seeks to answer one of life's most important questions, so what?